Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement that seeks to advocate on behalf of children in matters of marriage and family. That means that where relationship news goes, we go as well. So we're going to be talking about demographics. We're going to be talking about dating. And we're going to be talking about our new campaign that we are spearheading to retake marriage on behalf of children and overturn Obergefell. I am joined, as I often am, by Josh Wood, my executive director at Them Before Us. We're going to talk a little bit about a graph that Mike Lee put up on his X account talking about the abysmal birth rate across the United States. But before we do, we always spend a little bit of Bible time. My son, my 18-year-old, is going through the Bible in a year. So we are in the middle of Exodus right now. Just today, we like went through all the candlesticks and all the altars and all of the different table of presents and how to make it and everything. And you look at that and you're like, okay, it's kind of boring, except there's some really awesome things that stand out. Like the first time the Spirit of God was ever on anybody was an artist, not a priest, not a king. It was an artist. But the thing that really stuck out to me is when we were reading about all the things that was needed for the temple, for making all of the instruments and the furniture in the temple, people were bringing what they had. They were bringing metal, they were bringing jewels, they were bringing fine fabrics, and they kept bringing it every day as a goodwill offering. And then it said the people were bringing so much that it was more than enough. And then finally, Moses said, stop. Stop, we have enough. Stop bringing things. He had to command them, do not bring me the precious things in your life. Don't bring any more sacrifices. We don't want your gold. And I'm like, has this ever happened before? Has there ever been a situation where people were so collectively energized by a mission and by a project where God says, tell the people we have enough resources? I actually couldn't think of it. I should have looked it up before this, but I didn't. I've never known of a time where God said, please stop bringing me offerings, but he did. And I was like, what would it take for us to do that again? What would it take for us to say, you can have it all. I'm going to bring you costly things. And it wasn't just this general, like, I'm going to offer this to God. Like they had a set structure. This was for a specific mission and a specific project where all of God's people were on the same page to the point where God says, stop giving. Thoughts on that, Josh?
I was thinking, man, I have a friend here in town who often says you can't outgive God. That even at some level, even those people contributing to that level, they understood, especially, you know, Exodus, they're fresh out of Egypt. I think why would someone give to that level? I think when you experience Passover and deliverance and you come from nothing at the brink of death and slavery, you've seen infanticide, you come from all of that. I think you go, everything I have is God's anyway. The only reason I'm here is because of God. And if we are going to prosper, it's going to be because he's blessing us. So I do wonder if that mindset is connected to the gift.
There definitely was some kind of spiritual fervor that ignited in them. Because my 18-year-old was like, wait a second. Literally 2 days ago, we were reading about the people worshiping the golden calf. Right? And so I'm like, how? It was a lesson in like, we can be very fickle. Because like you said, totally rescued from centuries of slavery, seeing God's wonder through the plagues, leading them on dry ground through the Red Sea, watching their enemies be totally obliterated by an act of God, and then quickly turning aside, making their own idols, worshiping and bowing down, and then being corrected, and then led into a place where God was going to give them a pattern and a design for true worship. And that energized them and that motivated them to give. And so we did talk about how it's kind of like us, where we have seasons where we fail miserably, we turn around and we say, I'm going to give it all to you.
It does. Yeah. You kind of get up that thing that people always point to, the hypocrisy in Christians, and look at all the bad things people have done. And I think it is helpful in this kind of moment to just step back and go, we agree, we're all hypocrites. We're the only ones saying that we're going to get it wrong 99% of the time. It's only, in fact, the times where we advance something really great, like glory to God that we got something right. It's a totally flipped perspective from this kind of secular progressivism that expects that we're somehow marching in our, you know, our elevated mindset towards some new morality and we're so much better than we ever were. It's like, no, you should absolutely expect that they were doing the golden calf thing yesterday and today we've got it right. That's human nature. That's why we all need a savior and that's why we need forgiveness.
It's interesting because, you know, we at Them Before Us, we do work not primarily with a scriptural underpinning to why it is we're doing what we're doing. All of us are committed Christians. All of us spend time with the Word of God, are trying to raise our children in the admonition of the Lord. But our work at Them Before Us is not primarily appealing to the authority of the Word of God. We are appealing to the realities that God embedded into human nature and human relationships by studying the world of God, by looking at social science, by looking at natural law, by looking at the lived experience of people who got it right and got it wrong. And one of the big conversations that's happening in the world of demography right now, in the world of marriage and family formation, is the birth crisis. The fact that we are not having enough babies. I remember when I was in high school, I was in a political science class and we had to read all of these articles about the risk and the danger of overpopulation. There's not going to be enough resources. We need to make sure that people aren't having enough children. If only that was the problem we were having today. Now, at least 70% of the world lives in countries that are not replacing themselves. You need 2.1 children for a country, for a culture to be able to just maintain the same level. The United States is about 1.6 overall. Europe, it's under 1.5. Japan has about 1.2. China is 1. South Korea is 0.75. And so really, if you're not in sub-Saharan Africa, you are not replacing yourself. You are not having enough children. So that's been a bit of the topic that we've been tracking on social media. And Mike Lee had a couple posts about that. Did you see any of them, Josh?
Oh, yeah. I feel like everybody had a take on why this is our problem. Because people don't have enough support. People don't have enough money. It's so hard. They don't make cars for car seats. Like, there's just like all the takes.
Yeah. So now, if you're dialed in at all to what's happening in the family formation space, everybody knows that the birth crisis is probably the most important thing that nobody's talking about. It is going to impact everything. It is going to impact the economy. It's going to impact loneliness. It's going to impact lifespan. It's going to impact the medical world. I mean, like, it is going to have implications for every part of life. And so, of course, the way that a lot of people want to solve this is money. Like, let's solve this by money. Let's try to subsidize childcare. Let's give tax breaks for people that have children. Let's try to incentivize women to prioritize motherhood. But interestingly, this has been a problem for a lot of nations way before it was a problem for the United States. Japan has been dealing with this since the late 90s. Europe in the early 2000s realized it was a problem. A lot of those countries have really significant safety nets, like welfare safety nets. And so they do get generous, like maternal leave and paid childcare from the moment the baby can, you know, like squirm on their own outside of the womb. It doesn't look like money is the solution to the problem. And yet government is powerless to do anything other than money. So any thoughts, Josh? I mean, I have a lot of opinions. What are your opinions on like the real way out of this mess?
Well, I'll tell you what I don't love is people telling us that, you know, here's 62 solutions to having more babies, but completely missing the fact that we abort 1 million children a year. It's like, wait a second. If any conversation around this that doesn't start with how many children's lives are ended in the womb, like, then I'll disregard your opinion. Part two to this is I've also seen so many people who, because of these numbers, they just justify these insane policies for child creation. Like, basically, we need to just rubber stamp any two people, male, male, mother, father, like who want to create a child.
Yeah. A lot of people have said, well, if there's a problem with the population crisis, then why are you against IVF? Why are you against surrogacy? It's more babies. And the answer is it's a fraction. First of all, like the number is so small. Second of all, the number of children that are destroyed through those processes dwarf the number of children that are born alive. There is no way that we should be, can be, ought to be a society that improves our birth rate by destroying and commodifying children, right? We want more babies, but we don't just want babies anywhere, anytime, in any way. We want not just babies born, but babies raised. Babies raised by the two people who are going to developmentally advantage them, who are going to ground their identity, who are going to ensure that they are safe and loved, who are statistically the most likely to lead to not just more births, but thriving children. So what we need is not just babies. You know, my big take on this, and we're going to talk a little bit about this in the second segment, is we have a birth crisis because we have a marriage crisis. Fewer people are getting married. More people are cohabiting, and many more are simply opting out of marriage altogether. And we have a marriage crisis because we have a dating crisis. If you have any contact with somebody that is under the age of 30 or 35, you will hear that they, even if they want to get married, it's hard for them to find somebody to pair off with. And then I would argue further, we have a marriage, or we have a dating crisis because we have a friendship crisis. We have a whole generation of kids who know nothing but internet life and screen life. And that strips children of the daily repeated practice that they need interacting with people in person. They don't need to see anybody when they check out at the grocery store. They don't even need to go into a Target to get toothpaste. It will be delivered to their doorstep. So much of their lives are online. Their friendships are group chats. It's the Fortnite conversation they're having with their friend who lives in Australia. People are not interacting in person. And that makes it hard to then approach somebody in real life for a date.
But yeah, this one is such an onion, right? There's millions of layers. Another one being the total lack of sex that's being had in the U.S. In or out of marriage, to be quite honest. Now, obviously, we would advocate for it in the context of marriage, but people don't go on dates. They don't. Some of that is because we've created these cell phones where I can just meet a woman online that's virtual, that's AI, that's, 100 million ways to watch porn, and it's good enough that it affects massively someone's desire to go out, to go meet somebody, to date. They're finding ways to satisfy these what are natural desires in so many unhelpful ways. And you look around, you go, we're disconnected. Our young men are addicted to porn. We don't hang out anymore. We don't have relationships. Our teens are being radicalized by these ideologies on social media, right and left. I mean, look at how far. I mean, men have stayed a little more neutral from where they were ideologically a decade ago. Women are off the charts, going progressive. Of course we have problems. Of course. What did we expect?
Yeah, it is myriad. And it all really does have to do with the disconnection from our own humanity, from the fact that we are relational creatures. We are embodied creatures. We are a mind-body unity. And so much of the bodily needs that we have that were meant to be met through other people have moved online. Friendships, romantic, sexual, educational, commercial, like all of the different ways that we used to have regular in-person contact. Families are shrinking. We're not living near grandparents. We don't even have the extended generational family to practice with. There's less children, so there's less cousins. We are actually starving kids, this next generation, of ways that they used to practice and live out their humanity. So we're going to talk a lot more in the next segment about how do we right that wrong? How do we rectify it? I just published the first of one of a series of three on dating at our Them Before Us Substack. If you go to Substack and type in Them Before Us, the most recent post is us setting up the fertility crisis, which is a marriage crisis, which is ultimately a dating crisis. And you'll see all the numbers Josh and I were just talking about. Hold on, we're gonna come back and we're gonna talk about how to make dating great again.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, here with Josh Wood, Executive Director of Them Before Us. And we are talking about dating. In the last segment, we set up how there is a birth crisis that is coming from a marriage crisis that ultimately is a dating crisis. There was a big mistake that Christians especially made in the 90s at the peak of the casual sex moment. And it was to kiss dating goodbye. And we said, look, this is too dangerous. You're going to hook up. You're going to get pregnant. You're going to get an STD. And so Christian parents told their kids, don't date. Dating is bad. You can only date for marriage when you're ready to get married. Well, the problem is a lot of people don't feel like they're ready to get married until they're 28 or 32 or 38. And that's a big problem because that is too late to, number one, find a great candidate to marry. And number two, to have a baby or seven. So we are going to be able to fix the birth crisis only if we fix the marriage crisis, only if we get dating right. So this week, I am going to publish my roadmap for healthy dating, what I think we should be communicating about dating. I'm going to give you a quick hit, and then Josh is going to jump in here because he has got a lot of close contact with young adults, both who are dating and who are newly married. And he's also been able to coach them through a lot of the challenges on both sides of the vow. Here's how I think it should go. There is a documentary called The Dating Project, and it follows Professor Cronin, who teaches a very popular course at Boston University that is always standing room only on how to date, because college students do not know how to do it. They either permanently friend zone all the time, or they hook up in a drunken stupor, and there's never any slow process to evaluate, get to know, and unfold a relationship over time. So she identifies three different levels of dates. The first one is the group date, where you're just hanging out in mixed groups together. Low pressure, no commitment. The second one is a level two date where you ask somebody out. It is short. It is alcohol free. It has no strings attached. And then the third is level three, where you are now exclusive with one another. There are boundaries around that relationship. There is an expectation it's going to continue and it may move towards marriage. So here's what I think. Lots of level one in middle school. A lot of parents, especially Christian parents, will freak out if their middle schooler is chatting with or passing notes to somebody of the opposite sex. Stop. Stop. They need more sweet, age-appropriate, non-romantic connection with the opposite sex in middle school, and we should encourage it. Next, encourage your child in high school to do some level two dates, especially in their junior and senior year. Get your sons to practice asking a girl out for a, hey, can I pick you up for coffee? I can have you home in an hour and a half. I'm just really enjoying having you on the debate team. And I'd love for us to be able to get together and just chat, get to know each other, right? Lower the barriers, make it really easy for guys to ask and really easy for girls to say yes. And then level three, you should encourage your son or daughter to date in college. I think that I know I've seen the data on parents, even Christian, even conservative parents who say marriage and family is not a high priority. Financial independence is a high priority. That is the wrong message to be sending to your teens and to your young adults and your college students. You should consider college to be the best opportunity. I don't want to say the last, but maybe the last opportunity for them to be around like-minded peers in a place where there's lots of in-person contact, where they can start to develop a relationship as a friendship and that might lead to a dating relationship. And you should encourage that and promote it in college so that your kids can get married in their early 20s, mid-20s, if possible, so that you can have grandchildren and they can have the children that most people say that they want, but don't get to have if they form those relationships too late. Josh, jump in here and tell me your thoughts on dating and kind of how you think that that course correction needs to happen.
Well, it's interesting because everything you said is stuff that occurs in person. It's like going and asking somebody, seeing them at school, like, but that's just not what we have today. Like the vast majority of this, and this part of what made us is making us unwell, is everyone has their own little PR firm. It's like a perfectly manicured Instagram or Snap, and you're like, you're only posting things that make you look a certain way, and they're obviously incredibly visual. It's not like, you know, young women are getting on there and bearing their soul as a way to attract men. I mean, the whole platform is just oriented towards, and men do this too, oriented towards the visual, the physical. And so we, again, the not to mention the types of people that get on those platforms that are not not young men, you know, not young men reaching out to women. We just actually had one here in Charlotte where a young lady on Snap met a guy she thought was younger, picked her up, trafficked her. I mean, they caught him at the state line. This is someone that I was connected to. I knew her family.
Oh my gosh.
And they found her with a guy she met on Snapchat who had just slid in, started messaging her. I'm like, primarily the channels through which we're communicating are structurally setting us up for visual, physical, surface level connection that almost bears no risk. Having to type out a message like that to ask someone out is the lowest bar ever, requires no courage, and also allows you to also say things you would never say to a woman in person, you know, not nice things. So yeah. Part of me goes, man, some of what I love about what you just shared is it almost emphasizes that you need to spend some time with your phone in your pocket talking face to face with a person of the opposite sex over coffee, on a walk, doing something in nature, touching grass. You know, it's like if we could just get there, I think that's even just a better context for this all to occur.
I have a post that's coming out this Thursday. So if you want to hear all of my opinions about dating and the specific how-tos that need to take place in those different age stages, go to Them Before Us Substack and subscribe. And that one is going to be free because I really do think that Christians need to show the rest of the world how this is done. But yes, the problem here is too much has moved into the digital space. So much is online. And like you said, that has risks, not just because we are not practicing, but because you're not even actually getting a real picture of who these people are. Maybe it's somebody you know in real life, but they have an extremely curated profile. But sometimes that's not even who they are. I sent my 18-year-old, some Instagram reel about a teen boy who was blackmailed because he thought that it was the real profile of a girl he knew in real life, but it was really like a Nigerian gang that was going to extort him. And then he committed suicide. And I was like, hey, FYI, just to let you know, make sure that the person you're talking to is really the person that you're talking to. Because like, you're right, the risks are just myriad. But even if you're not talking about the Nigerian gang or the girl that's getting trafficked on state lines, what is happening right now is the infiltration of screens into our children's lives, the limited contact that they are having with embodied people at school, in their families, in their friend networks, and in their dating life means that they're actually not able to make those connections. When they then do find somebody that they're romantically interested in, it takes a lot of courage for a guy to ask, a lot of courage. Like, let's say they were not in the digital space and he just wants to ask her out for coffee. It still takes a lot of courage. Why is it even harder now? Number one, because he's never talked to a girl in real life. All of his interactions with everyone is digital. So now he's overcoming the barrier of a real person connection and an in-person connection with a girl he has a crush on. Number two, if that goes poorly, he's not alone in his shame. She could share it everywhere, right? There's very high stakes in the digital age when it comes to asking out. So we need to encourage our sons to have an embodied ask. But here's the other side of things. We need to coach our daughters to say yes. If a guy, like a high schooler or a college student, has the guts to ask our daughters out, they should say yes. They should reward him for risking. They should reward him for having the courage to walk across a room and make a real person request. Not if the guy's creepy or if they feel like she'd be unsafe with him, but if we're going to rebuild a dating culture, that means that we need to encourage both guys and girls to do something that's a little outside of their comfort zone.
Yeah, well, I think what you just described as well is bought-in parents. I mean, helping them walk through this pathway. But again, some of me thinks, Katie, like, there is some value in institutions, like the pools in which, like, we value in my family that we are in certain spaces where we are more aligned with the parents, their values than others. Now, I do think you got to pre-decide some of this stuff. Like, we've even talked with our kids about sleepovers and about common spaces and what, you know, even hanging out with other families, where those kids go by themselves. And I do think there's some like really active parenting and pre-deciding the context. But I will say, not that I'm, you know, the, what do they call it? The Benedict option, retreat from society type of person, but it is incredibly valuable when you're putting your kid into situations where there's a better chance than not that the parents around you are going to reinforce things that, that you care about, or their kids are going to reflect some of the values that you care about, whether that's Christian schools, getting them in church and youth group, if they're in public schools, I mean, getting them in church and youth group either way. And then also Christian colleges. I mean, I met my wife at a Christian college, and her father is fond of saying that, like, her finding a husband was worth every penny of the tuition above a state school. And I get it. As a dad of a daughter now, I'm like, yeah, that's probably worth it. It's expensive. It definitely is. But the chances that she's going to find an incredible, godly man and a leader who's going to take care of her, man, okay, I'll sign that check.
I have a section on choosing colleges in the dating post that is going to come out on Thursday. And it basically is, I understand that there's skepticism about college. None of my children are going to go into debt. We are like trying to be very creative to make sure that all of them will graduate without any debt. And it's really hard, especially when you are going to have, you know, 2 to 3 that are all needing tuition in the next couple of years. But I will also say that if we want them to get married, and if we want them to have a large pool to choose from, and if we want them to have the time to really develop those friendships and then figure out, like, wow, like, you and I really get along. Wow, we've got worldview alignment. I've had time to study your character. Christian college is the place where that's going to happen. And, you know, our oldest went to a school that was about 50-50. Right? And you have to look at gender ratios when you send them to college. So she was all set, 50-50. Our second daughter, soccer player, wanted to go to Grand Canyon. It was 73% female. I'm like, your college is not, your soccer career is not worth having a 3-to-1 ratio with the guys. I mean, you're wonderful. You're a catch, but you are also a 10. And I don't want you to think that the sixes are your only option. And so she went to a place that was much closer to parity. She's got a sweet boyfriend. Don't know if they're going to make it all the way to marriage, but they're being very, very deliberate about level 3. Our son, our 18-year-old, I'm like, you could totally go to Grand Canyon if you want. Like, you having the advantage as it relates to the male-female ratio, that's fine with me. He's looking at another school where there's a little more balance, but he still does have a bit of a female advantage there. You need to be strategic. A lot of you guys, if you are 40 and older, you came from a generation where it just happened. Or if you wanted to reach out and develop a relationship, you had the skills to do it. That is not the world we live in today. Mm-hmm. You need to coach your kids. You need to be strategic with them. You need to talk with them about all of these different constraints as it relates to the digital world and how it is sucking their opportunities to connect. You need to talk to your daughters the most about why they don't have all the time in the world when it comes to marriage and motherhood.
Have you seen that chart, Katie, where it goes like this generation you were just talking about? It's like met through a friend at work, met through church, met. And it's like all of those metrics, it's like the Great Depression. They've just tanked. And what's the one that's gone up? It's online dating.
Mm-hmm. Well, like, that's the world they know. They know how to connect online. It is the medium of the next generation. The problem is online connection through dating apps is very often the commodification, right? You are actually looking at them as an object to be used, not a person to be connected with. And here's the other big problem with apps. It prioritizes hotness to such a degree that character and worldview really aren't even a part of the equation. Like, you're kind of lucky if you do end up finding somebody that really is a match when it comes to worldview. There really is not a substitute for an embodied connection. I think that we should help young adults make those connections.
Don't you? We were actually watching my wife and I a movie from like 2003, 2002. And the thing that stuck out to us, and this is so sad, was how all of the lead characters look so different. Like, one had a little gap in her teeth. One had messy hair. One had like it, like you could see freckles. And what we kind of noticed was, man, every movie we watch now, everyone looks exactly the same. It's from everything from fillers to Botox to like you name it, to hair a certain way, to perfect veneers, to you get to the point where you're like, oh my gosh, there was almost like a quirkiness back in the day of everyone looks different and individual, and you're kind of, you know, you're good looking in your own way, versus now I feel like the curation, the PR-itization of social media has made everyone have to fit into this perfect, narrow, contoured standard of beauty, or else, I mean, male and female, or else you're ugly.
Yep. There are perils. Perils abound when it comes to relationship formation in the future. I'm going to have one more post that comes out after my kind of prescription for dating. And it is, what do all of the people and the supportive roles look like? What does it look like from a parent's perspective in terms of making sure that you are setting your kids up for success? What does it look like when it comes to the church? What can the church do? The church is made for this. Like, we are made for this, especially if you have not moved completely to online church. Major on those in-person spaces, those gatherings, certainly for everybody, but definitely for those times where young people can get together and hang out. I know that there's been a lot of trash talking about youth group, you know, and everybody does youth ministry wrong. But you know what? Youth group is a pretty incredible place for like-minded kids to come together and have some of those in-person interactions. And you know what else? Your church should have a matchmaker. In my next post, I'll tell you exactly how to do that if you feel like you are the woman to make sure that these kids are pairing off well together.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Hey everyone, welcome to Here for the Comments, your political and cultural commentary with Jen and Sam. Hi Sam, good to see you.
Hi Jen.
All right, we have, of course, I mean, it's just an endless stream of things we could talk about and enjoy talking about, but one of the tweets that hit today, got a little bit viral today, was one about some new divorce merch. I don't know if you feel like you need this in your life, Sam, being happily married, but you know, you never know when you're going to need your divorce sweatshirt. This was a tweet. This company, I believe, is called Reformation. Introducing the divorce collection. And it says, the shirt that the sweatshirt this lady is wearing says, "Dump him." And it says, "With a collection made for women who don't settle in court or when it comes to clothes, featuring sexy, empowering things like a limited edition Dump Him sweatshirt, in case your friends keep asking you for relationship advice." Now, it's different if you're talking to your friends about your deadbeat boyfriend. My boyfriend plays video games all day and he doesn't want to get a job. I want to get married and he wants to shack up. And then you want to give her a Dump Him sweatshirt? Okay, great. We're pretty for that at Them For Us. But what do you think about a Dump Him sweatshirt for a wife?
I just think it's funny when they talk out of both sides of their mouths. Like, they're the same people who say, "We don't promote divorce. What are you talking about? We're feminists and we just think everyone should do what they want and everything works as long as it works for them. Nothing's wrong." And then, like, this is like, this is advertising divorce. That's what this is. It's sexy and empowering to dump your husband. That's wild. That's a wild thing to be throwing out there. And like, oh, it's a sweater. So that way, if any of your friends come to ask you for advice, like, oh, I don't think I'm looking for my like advice from divorce friends, to be honest. Right. So I don't know. I think it's honestly, I feel like it's the biggest cope. Like, I feel like the average person has to be seeing through that, right? Like, when you look at that person, like, I don't think when I see you wear that and when you talk about how fun divorce is, I just don't believe you. Like, I think you're sad and I think you have a right to be sad because divorce is really awful. It's traumatizing. Even if you want a divorce, it's still such a hard process. And like, there's a lot of emotions that come up through it. And like, I just, it doesn't matter how nice of a sweatshirt you make. I just don't believe that, like, you're excited about what you just went through. So,
yeah. Lila Rose tweeted, "This is the latest example of a millennial brand trying to be edgy and cool, but instead promoting one of the greatest tragedies in American society." And let's give the caveat. There are legitimate moral reasons to get divorced. But guess what? The people who have to do those things aren't getting a sweatshirt about it. The people who have to get divorced because their spouse leaves them for someone else or abandons them or is abusing them or their children might have to go file for separation and divorce and get help like that. But those aren't the people who are celebrating it. They're not celebrating with divorce selfies, which is something we wrote about. It was some adults with an amicable divorce that were like, here's a divorce selfie when we signed our papers. And Katie wrote about that. She said, guess who's not pictured? Who's not smiling in that picture? Their children. And as much as people want to gaslight us and say, kids are resilient and they'll be fine and they're going to be happier when they see their mom and dad not fighting, that's because, and I saw this tweet, the guy said, no, that's because you think children are thinking like adults do. If you're just bickering in front of your kids and you're pretty amicable and you're going to have an amicable divorce, guess what? That divorce hit your kids like a freight train. It destroyed their lives. And if you could be amicable after getting divorced, like it was we fell in a love situation or we're having problems with agreeing on how to handle money or communication, go get help. The answer is not buy a dump him sweatshirt and get divorced. You just wrecked your children's lives. And it's interesting because we get kind of considered like we're too harsh or we're not taking into account all these caveats because we're trying to help people understand how awful this is for children. And what's funny is we're talking to a society where most of us have experienced it from the kid side. So I, like you said, I think people can see through this because so many of us have had our parents get divorced. And even your parents getting divorced when you're older is really impacting people. So I just don't think it really, is it going to sell well? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think so too. And my favorite part is in like this little thread that they're sending out trying to get people to buy this sweater. It says it's the person wearing the sweater in the picture is starring acclaimed attorney Laura Wazer. I think is how to say her name, but it's just so funny that it's like, of course it's an attorney. Of course it's an attorney who's sitting here like trying to profit off of, like, you already profit off a divorce, and now you're just trying to make more money off of the divorces that you do. You probably sell these sweatshirts to all of your clients, and like, I feel that's so crazy to me that she's, like, doing that. But, and again, it's, like, what's not pictured there is her clients, who are probably, like, just distressed and, like, crying in her office and not sure how they're going to afford her bill and, like, going through the worst times of their lives. And she's just like, well, make it sexy. This will be fun. You know, this is empowering. I bet they don't feel very empowered when they're sitting in your office trying to divvy up everything they've built with their husband for the last 15 years. So, yeah, no, you're taking something that is, it's supposed to be sad. It's not supposed to be fun. And that's because you're breaking up something that was never meant to be broken. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter like how much you wish that life could always be a fun party time. Like it's not. So I feel like you just have to mourn with those who mourn and help those the best that you can and try to save the marriages that can be saved and not try to celebrate like the worst part of someone's life.
Well, and people who are listening to this who've been divorced, maybe it wasn't your choice, we're not condemning you at all. And the people who are listening, and maybe the divorce was your choice, but now you're starting to, I think we've had some messages like this, people who've said, man, you know, I made these decisions a while ago, divorce or using IVF or using a sperm donor. And now they're starting to recognize that I'm realizing what this cost my kids. We're for you as well. Every single one of us have made all sorts of mistakes because we didn't know better a lot of the time. And that's what Them Before Us is so passionate about. We're trying to educate as many people as possible to protect the rights of children. And if you've already messed up, now is the perfect time to start educating people and use your own story. We talk about the power of story is so huge. And what a difference it would make if people started sharing their stories. Yes, I chose to do IVF. And here's the reason I'm telling people not to do it. You know, so we just want to encourage people. We're not condemning you. Once you get on board with understanding that children's rights matter, then use your story to help other people and educate other people.
Yeah. I actually have a friend who... Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Well, I just have a friend, and that's what she does. She advocates against IVF, and it was because she went through IVF, and she tried to do it the quote-unquote Christian way, where you just do, like, one at a time, and you don't try to, like, throw out any of the embryos. And in the process, they were just pressured by these clinics, because they're just like, if you do one at a time, it's so expensive, it's hard on your body, the chances of it going through are, like, almost none. Like, if you really want a child out of this, you're going to have to create more than just one at a time. And so she felt like it was their only option to have a child. And I think she has like four or five more embryos, but they've already had, I think, three kids. And she's like now in her 50s, and she knows that she can't physically handle another pregnancy. And she is tormented. She's like, I can't stop paying this monthly bill to keep these embryos frozen because I know they're my children. I can't deal with the fact of like trying to adopt them out to strangers who I don't know if they would treat them well, and just knowing that they're my children and they're out in the world. And she doesn't believe in surrogacy because she doesn't want her child to experience the bond with a surrogate. And she also can't raise these kids. And so she's like, until I die, I'm going to be in this torment. And it's so traumatizing. And no one tells you that when they're taking your money, you know, they try to keep that part quiet. And so there's no judgment for people who have been through it. Like we have all learned the hard way because we've come so far as a society to promote these things and to act like they're normalized. And now we're seeing the implications. What it's hurting, how it's hurting children. So we're all in it together. We're all trying to get out of it together. We're all trying to protect the children together. So it's all we can do.
That's good. Yeah. One other series of tweets we'll talk about in our last few minutes here. From the Vemacorus account, I was engaging with some people who were tweeting us, and this guy, I'll call him Mike, has been going back and forth with Katie or myself or the Vemacorus organizational Twitter or X account. And what I think is so funny is sometimes I kind of pause and I'll ask people who are going back and forth with me, what's your comprehensive definition of marriage? And here's what I would say the them before us definition of marriage is. We would say it has to be one unmarried man consenting of age can marry one unmarried consenting of age woman. And then we say marriage has to be exclusive. There's no other parties, people coming in and out of that marriage. Monogamous, you're not sleeping with anyone else. Because people will say ethical, non-monogamy. It's like, well, it's sort of monogamous because we agree that I'm allowed to have one other person over here on the side. We're like, no, monogamous, exclusive, complementary, meaning one man, one woman, permanent for life until someone dies. And that's how we would define it. So that to me feels that is holding true across all culture, time, space, everything. And I'll ask Mike here to define it. And he said, what did he say? It has to be a legal affirmation of an agreement between two people, blah, 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 blah. And I just focus on the part that I know he's going to say, which is that it's two people. I'm like, okay, why? Why is it two? And this is a guy who identifies as gay and talks about his husband on Twitter. And why does it have to be two people? Well, because he literally said, because we said so. As a society, we've decided that that's what it is. I was like, first of all, that's pretty new in society, right? And not all societies in 2026 even think that's true. If you go back to Greek and Roman times, it wasn't necessarily like that. You go back to ancient Jewish times, it wasn't like that in the Jewish history, Christian history in the Bible. It wasn't always like that. You always saw a lot of problems when it was done that way. But I was like, what do you mean two people? And just a little bit ago, we defined marriage. We said so. Marriage was between one man and one woman. You weren't content with that. You wanted to change it. And then I tweeted, I said, look, every pro-LGBT online activist who defines marriage as between two people has no argument for why. But we're bigots because we define it. Yeah, it has to be two people based on natural law and biology. One man, one woman. That's the only way you can create the next generation. But we're bigots and they're in reality just a bigot at a slightly different line than we are. What would be your reply to that, Sam?
Yeah, basically the same. I feel like most people that argue with truth, like, you can't get two sentences or two questions in before they're already confused by their own logic. And so this is like a perfect example of that, where it's like, you know, you sound so sure of your definition that you just randomly made up that you've never thought about before in your life. And then like we ask one follow-up question and it's like you're already kind of backpedaling and trying to figure it out because you didn't actually put thought into it. And it's like, what we've put a lot of thought into it, and we didn't even need to put that much thought into it because it's just something that's been known and true for since the beginning of time. Adam and Eve were the first husband and wife, you know, like done deal, you know? So, yeah, it always cracks me up.
Yeah. And he was saying too, look, the purpose of marriage is for the legal implications. My husband and I deserve to be able to visit each other in the hospital, et cetera. And I was like, no, that's not what marriage is. Marriage is not a government seal of approval on your choices, your personal beliefs and behaviors. And I was like, this is what marriage is. And consenting adults should be able to make the arrangements they want. Yes. An individual who identifies as gay should be able to tell a hospital, this individual can come and visit me and make decisions on my behalf. If that's the same sex, that 100% should be a thing. I should be able to leave my property to who I want. But he wants all the benefits of marriage and then simultaneously is denying that to poly relationships. And I was like, don't you think they want the legal benefits, the tax write-off, the government approval? And his argument to that is, well, no, because it's crazy. Everybody kind of will align eventually. And I was like, bro, you're behind. And I showed him the AP shows that it's on the rise. Olympia, Washington State, is trying to change it. So now they will enjoy some legal benefits, like poly relationships. So it's like, bro, you're arguing against now things that people are using the exact same argument you're using with me. So admit you're a bigot too, then, at least just in a different spot than us.
Yeah, no, it's always so funny, like the way they think these things through, like, they know what they want and they're going to fight for them, but they don't know why they want them or why it's okay that they want them. So,
yeah, it's funny. Okay. Yeah. If you want to join us, helping us in the comments, join our TBU ambassador program. We're going to do training. We're going to have a community of people that talk to each other and build each other up. We're going to have a retreat at some point in the year. You'll get some swag. We're building that team. So you can email us and let's see. What would you say is kind of like some final advice, Sam, for people who want to start engaging online, but they're a little bit scared?
Do it, because the more you do it, the more comfortable you get with it. You're definitely going to feel those scary moments and you're not going to know how to respond sometimes, but you just have to work through it. And then at some point it just clicks and you get comfortable. So I say just push through it.
All right, cool. Thanks everyone for joining us on this edition of Here for the Comments, and we will catch you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.